from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out what happened when some first ladies dared to raise their hemlines.
I'll get a preview of the Write Stuff Writers and Readers Conference in Carmel.
And I'll chat with Karen Irwin about her portrayal of Janis Joplin. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Raising the Hem, Historic Fashions of American Nobility, is a new exhibit at the President Benjamin Harrison Home that features dresses of several first ladies, including Caroline Harrison, Mary Lincoln, Grace Coolidge, and Mamie Eisenhower, just to name a few. Sharon Gamble invited Harrison Home President Phyllis Giesling and VP of Curatorship and Exhibition Jennifer Capps to our studios to learn more.
So I love that a museum dedicated to a man does so much programming, always has, dedicated to the role of first ladies and women in general. And I'm curious where the idea of raising the hem came from.
Victorian clothing and first ladies clothing is always a very popular subject matter for our guests. And a few years ago, we've had a couple of different exhibits that have focused on similar topics, but this one's a little bit different. And always know that they are wanting to come and see those types of items and see the first lady's clothing and the accessories of the Harrison women are very popular viewing items for our public today.
Sure. And so, but you started that era and you go forward. And is the exhibit in chronological order?
To some extent, the exhibit is throughout the home, mm-hmm. So that's always nice. We have actually over about 27 dresses out in the house right now. So there are, you know, four or five on the first floor, a few on the second floor, and then more of them on the third floor, which is our main exhibit area. And so it is somewhat chronological, or the dresses that are out in the house are more of the Harrison time period, the, you know, 1870s, 1880s, 1890s time period. And then when you get to the third floor, you do have more of the modern first ladies like Grace Coolidge and Eleanor Roosevelt, and coming on up to the 1950s with Mamie Eisenhower.
Not that you would do this, but Phyllis, is there an ensemble that you've just looked at and said, oh, I would wear that in a heartbeat?
Well, there are some that I've looked at and thought, oh, I would love to wear that, but not in this day and time.
Sure.
But some of Mrs. Harrison's clothes were just exquisite.
Were they made? Where were they made? Did she have a?
I think that she bought some ready-made, but most of them were made for her here in the States, sometimes in New York City, sometimes in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And they're beautiful, beautifully tailored.
Jennifer, fair game, same question. Again, not that you would do this because these are fragile and important objects, but is there one ensemble that you'd say, oh, man, that's so me, that's so my style?
They're all gorgeous, and that there are a couple of favorites I have, and actually Grace Coolidge is one of them. Or, of course, you have the 1920s and the whole idea of the raising the hem a little bit there.
Sure.
Where you've gotten to a more straighter, simpler line, that you don't have all of the undergarments and whatnot as well. But it's just very elegant, a very classic dress for her, a little bead and sequin work on it. So just very pretty, a paler color. But I have to say that my favorite piece is a Harrison piece. It probably belonged to the daughter, Mary Harrison McKee. And it's actually a little capelet, like a little jacket.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a cotton velveteen. It's a brown, kind of brown, rusty orange colors, heavily beaded. In fact, it weighs quite a bit. I'm not sure how you could wear it, especially her with a smaller frame. It would be quite heavy. But the arms are kind of a fishnet crocheted and with beads worked into them as well. But just an absolutely gorgeous piece, and something if you were going to a fancy outing today that you certainly could wear.
It sounds like beautiful workmanship on all of these garments, actually. Now, I'm curious, first ladies of every era have faced a lot of pressure because, fairly or unfairly, they are seen, and the first man, the first husband, will be seen this way sometime in the future as well, but they will be seen as very important for how they appear. And that bothers me a lot, being a modern woman. But what kinds of pressures, have those pressures gone all the way back into the Victorian era? Was there pressure on Mrs. Harrison to set a style for the rest of the country, to try to adopt a new way of dressing, or to reflect a particular color that might be in vogue that season? What do we know about sort of the psychological aspect of how the first ladies dressed?
I think Mrs. Harrison was quite a fashion plate, and more than anything, because I think she really loved it. She loved being dressed well, and she was an artist, so she had a wonderful eye for design and
sure.
tailoring and color, and she always looked good. I think that that the first ladies were observed. I think maybe Caroline made an equal impression on the country with her china painting.
Sure.
And it became quite a fad, quite a hobby for all women across the country, because Caroline was a wonderful china painter. And so china painting clubs, china painting classes picked up all over the country, and I think she influenced that.
Lead by example,
mm-hmm.
yeah, which the current First Lady is trying to do with her organic gardens.
Gardening.
And I think that's working, too.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer, do you have any evidence that there was ever criticism or pushback from how any of these First Ladies dressed?
I think they're always looked at, and as we saw more recently with the current First Lady, you know, they're looking at what she's wearing to the inaugural parade and to different events, and, oh, she's worn that dress again. But, you know, I think all of the First Ladies do realize that they are in the public eye, and while their personal tastes and whatnot are going to come through, they're always, you know, aware of that to some extent. And I'm not aware of any, you know, real... pushback.
No scandals.
Yeah, as far as dress goes necessarily. And going back to Caroline Harrison for a moment, too, you know, her inaugural gown was all American made, and that kind of tied in with her husband's theme of protection to home industry. So
sure.
that kind of an influence there as well. And again, with her artistic eye and sense, the pattern and design for her silk was actually an Indiana woman who designed the pattern. And so American design, American silk. So you have those influences that are coming in as well. Yeah, where are they shopping? And I think, you know, with Michelle Obama today, they're looking at where she's shopping, and can the common person go out and afford to buy the jacket she had on?
That's why I love, I'm trying to remember where it was, but I remember in Mrs. Obama's first term, she talked about shopping for clothes off the rack at someplace fairly modest. It might have been the Gap or something like that. And you know, people were like, what? That's, you know, wow, that's a big deal. So as with any other position affiliated with a presidential administration, being the designer of the fashions is a big deal. Do we know, did a lot of these first ladies have sort of a designer of record, somebody who was always on call to design their clothes?
Well, the first one that kind of comes to my mind is you think of Nancy Reagan, which our current exhibit only goes through the 1950s, so
sure.
we're not really including her. Prior to that, I'm not as familiar, but you know, that with the Harrisons, again, they had one particular shop in the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. area that the few pieces we have that have a label do have that particular dress label. Or actually, you know, they took the daughter-in-law took a trip to London and actually did purchase a dress over there, going to the same dressmaker as Robert Todd Lincoln's wife went to in London. So you have those kinds of connections through the years. But yeah, I think of, you know, probably Nancy Reagan as having one of the more fashionable wardrobes and maybe going to the designers a little bit more.
Well, and I think Mrs. Harrison was the first lady not to have a French gown for the inauguration.
So it truly was a political
mm-hmm,
statement to say,
mm-hmm. Oh, very
be
much
American,
so.
Buy American is a more mm-hmm. recent slogan that we think of. Wow. And it's not just dresses in this exhibit. It's lots of other things. For example,
We have fans, calling card cases, you know, purses and bags, hats, shoes. We have a lot of the shoes and some stockings that actually belong to Caroline and Mary Harrison McKee. One of the purses or bags that we have out right now special, and we should say also that some things rotate throughout the year for this exhibit. And one of the things that we have out right now is a beautiful, it's a bright blue silk dress that belonged to Caroline Harrison. It just looks very patriotic to me in the color it is. But we have with that right now a purse or bag that was made, probably a homemade item. We don't have a whole lot of history on it, probably given to the Harrisons at some point. But it has a flag motif, and also sewn into it is a Harrison political ribbon from 1888. So we have that displayed right now with the wonderful blue silk dress that belonged to Caroline Harrison.
I love that. How smart. How clever. We have this sort of contemporary association. Sometimes you watch a presidential address and the Democratic members of Congress all have blue ties and the Republicans all have red ties. Is there any evidence that there was any color differentiation between parties or conservatives versus liberals through the years for gowns and other ensembles?
Not that I'm aware of.
That would be taking it a little too far, probably. Yeah. There's a life-size paper doll. Tell us about that.
Yes, we actually have three dolls, so to speak, and they are three of the Harrison ladies. So we have Caroline, Mary Harrison McKee, the oldest daughter, and Elizabeth Harrison, which was his youngest daughter with his second wife. And we have six different gowns right now that they can dress the dolls with. And they're two each kind of from each of those generations. Since his youngest daughter was quite a bit younger, she hits that more of the 1920s, 1930s time period. So they have different gowns of the first ladies, actually, that are like sort of life-size paper dolls that the children or adults can dress the ladies.
What has been sort of the most popular part of, and keeping in mind that you are, rotating some of your holdings, but what has been the most popular part of this exhibition so far? It's been up for a few months. Is there something everybody always comments on when they leave? That's my favorite. I love that.
We have out at the moment a Mary Todd Lincoln dress. I think she's just a very popular first lady, and with the different movies and things out, it's very common. So we have that typical hoop skirt that you're looking at with Mary Todd Lincoln. But then I do think also just we actually have the parade dresses for Caroline and the daughter, Mary Harrison McKee, the dresses that they wore to the inaugural parade for Harrison at that time. But I think it kind of varies too. Everyone might have their favorite time period or favorite first lady.
How do these clothes get in a collection in the first place? Is there some tradition where first ladies since whatever year have left their fashion collection someplace? I mean, it's not like it's a presidential library, right? Mm-hmm. It's how do the clothes get to you?
The Harrison pieces that are on display are all part of our collection. Mm-hmm. Some of them were saved by the family and came back to the museum very early on, and then even in like the 1940s. So a lot of Caroline's dresses and the daughter Mary Harrison McKee, things that they had during that White House time period, were packed in trunks and saved. And actually they put dried tobacco leaves in between the dresses, and that was supposed to help keep the bugs out, especially the silk, if you have something that would want to come in and eat it.
It smell awful, but it would sure keep moths away. worked.
Yeah, they don't smell today. So yeah. So a lot of them were saved by the family. And then actually there was a family in New York by the name of Van Cortlandt who collected clothing and textiles, and especially first ladies clothing, and did so for several generations starting in the late 1800s. And a large portion of what we have on display, and a few of our pieces have been given to us later that came from that collection, but then we have things on loan from the National First Ladies Library in Canton, Ohio, And I know that several of the pieces came from that collection that were later sold, you know, to different organizations. And the Smithsonian today, I don't know if it's a written rule or kind of an unwritten rule, but the first inaugural ball gown, if a president happens to be elected twice, mm-hmm. the first inaugural ball gown is always donated or given to the Smithsonian for display. So that's kind of, you know, a longstanding tradition now, too.
Sharon Gamble with President Benjamin Harrison Home, President Phyllis Giesling, and VP of Curatorship and Exhibition Jennifer Capps. Raising the Hem, Historic Fashions of American Nobility is on view through December 31st at the Harrison Home. More information is available at presidentbenjaminharrison.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. On July 20th, the Palladium in Carmel will host the Write Stuff Across the Arts Literary Conference for writers, as well as readers, and filmmakers, too. Travis DiNicola spoke with conference organizer Andy Murphy, as well as Ray Robinson and Megan Weddle from Dog Ear Publishing, about the event.
Just give me a little background as far as what is exactly this Write Stuff Writers Conference that you are organizing. It's a pretty big deal.
It is a very big deal. Write Stuff Writers Conferences and Event was formed about 10 years ago, I founded mm-hmm. that, with the purpose of helping area writers realize their dream of knowing how to reach certain aspects of the creative within their own work. And this event, which is July 20th, it's going to be held in Carmel at the beautiful and magnificent Palladium Theater.
Yes.
If you've never been in there, I'm telling you, it's a wow factor.
Mm-hmm.
And we have engaged, put out a call, as I always do. It's a play it forward type of an event. I invite those who are successful, who have done well, have a lot of experience, to join with me on the stage in what we call our writer's studio to talk about their careers
mm-hmm.
and what they've learned and how they learn it and where. What advice do they give to anyone in the audience that might be considering writing or publishing?
And so the audience really would be made up of people who want to be writers as well as just people who love literature as well, right?
Well, that's the way it always was. But this year we've added a new twist, and mm-hmm. it's a first-time event for the Palladium mm-hmm. To allow on their stage, because they've always been a music organization where that's what they present.
Mm-hmm.
This time, we will present not only book authors at national level, regional level, but we're bringing in filmmakers, Academy Award winners, Emmy Award winners.
Mm-hmm.
We're bringing in publishers. They're all national. They all work and live here in Indiana, but they're nationally known. We're bringing in feature columnists.
Well, tell me some of the names of the people you're bringing in.
We have Michael Sheldon from
Simon & Schuster.
Simon & Schuster, mm-hmm. his new book, The Young Titans, which is a magnificent biography of Winston Churchill. We have Edward Kelsey Moore, who is with Knopf, and his latest book was a Barnes & Noble Pick of the Year book.
Wow.
It's an incredible. Mm-hmm. He's incredible. Michael Sheldon, who knew? He lives in Terre Haute. Mm-hmm. Edward Kelsey Moore was born and raised here in Indiana. He now is working, he's a noted cellist, and he's in Chicago, so we did make that one exception.
Okay.
We have Rebecca Dockledge. She lives in Carmel. We have Anne Craig Cinnamon. She is a first-time debut author writing memoirs. Mm-hmm. She lives here, she lives in Fishers. We have Matthew Tully. We have T.J. Baines from the Star, and Jolene Katzenberger mm-hmm. from the Indianapolis Star, and Kathy Keitinger.
Excellent.
So mm-hmm. we have, that is sort of, we have independent filmmakers mm-hmm. as well, who have produced and distributed movies right here in Indiana. Our publishers, we have national publishers, the Saturday Evening Post, Dog Ear Publishing, who's located here.
Well, which we'll hear about in just a moment.
I know. Mm-hmm. And we have a Town Post, and we have Andy Reid's books, which is wonderful.
Well, we're thrilled to be a part of that, too. But again, I mean, this is really for aspiring authors, professional authors, but the general public is welcome
right.
as well.
If you love books, you love movies, mm-hmm. you want to know about the film festival, Heartland Film Festival is,
okay.
their execs will be on the stage, And it's question and answer, so you can ask the questions maybe you've always wanted to. But we hope to encourage, if you've had a creative bent, you're thinking about writing or publishing, that's what Write Stuff has always...
And this is really an all-day event, isn't it?
It is. It starts at noon, and it goes until 6 o'clock. There's an after-party of wine and cheese. There's a 30-minute presentation by Dog Ear on the new world of publishing, what to expect, what to know. And then Heartland Film Festival is going to give us a special surprise movie in the theater, which I'm not allowed to tell you what it is.
Well, that's all right. We'll find out when we're there. Let me turn it towards Ray and Megan from Dog Ear. Great to have both of you joining us as well. Ray, so Dog Ear's been around, what now, about, you said 9 years?
We're about 9 years old at this point.
Okay, and you're one of the owners and founders with a couple other partners?
Yep, I have two partners, Miles Nelson and Alan Harris.
Tell me how this all came to be.
In the world before Dog Ear, we specialized in being a production house for traditional publishers. It means we built books for McGraw-Hill or Prentice Hall. And there came a point where we realized that more and more authors were being excluded from the market because they didn't have access to getting books built. The game had changed. Fewer and fewer authors were actually making it to shelves. Publishers were reducing who they brought in. They weren't taking chances on the new voices in the publishing world. And we realized that what we did for publishers, we could simply turn a little bit and do for independent authors. So we designed our world so that any author who wanted to take the risk of publishing had the opportunity to have a book that was built as well as any from any traditional publisher and let the market decide, as opposed to just a few titans in offices in New York somewhere, let the market decide how these books would work and would they succeed out there.
So Dog Ear, it's a self-publishing company,
correct.
But it sounds like you also do a lot of work with your authors to help them develop their style, their voice, their presentation, what the book looks like, all those things. I mean, Meg, that's kind of part of your job, correct?
Yes, I'm an author representative for Dog Ear, and I primarily, you know, talk to the authors when they first call in, and I help guide them through, you know, the process of publishing, talk to them about the different services. You know, we offer everything from, you know, professional editing to obviously getting the book built into full distribution so it's available in the marketplace. And then we also have marketing tools, book trailers, websites, lots of different services that the author can choose from. And my job is to help guide the author and help them decide what's going to help them as an individual, you know, get their book noticed and picked up and, you know, people, you know, to want to read it.
Ray, is there any particular genre or geography you're focused on? Or
no, any self-publisher, we are in most ways mercenaries in the market, to be frank.
Sure.
That's what we do. And we will bring any book, unless it's, you know, hate or porn or something really, really rotten, to the market because the market needs to decide that. So we can make a beautiful cover for anything. We can create a great interior. We don't say we only want fiction, we only want nonfiction. We let every book and every genre have the opportunity out there to win. And there are certainly some that do better than others. There are some that don't do that well, but it's not really genre specific.
And their authors are from all over the United States. That's what I'm saying. Dog Ear is located here
in
Indiana,
sure,
but they are nationwide.
And international, too.
International.
We have Australian authors from England, so everywhere. It's really fun. It's interesting.
So, Ray, Megan, I mean, your involvement with this authors conference that's taking place, what will you be talking about? You'll be sort of presenting a forum, giving some advice?
Yep. So our goal with the Write Stuff was such a perfect match because the Write Stuff works in a lot of ways with authors as they're developing their voice writing. The next step is you go from writing to publishing. Self-publishing's it's the Wild West. The opportunity to make decisions that have a tremendous financial impact for minimal reward is really high.
And some of the best writers may not have the best skills in terms of business or sense of publishing.
Right. So our goal for the
I'm just a guess. Right?
Creative types.
Megan, you're like nodding your head. It's almost going
to
fall off.
You're nodding. It's hard to see on radio. So the goal is to educate people so you don't spend a ton of money for no effect for a lousy product.
Sure.
And we come in it as Dog Ear. We certainly have a vested interest. But really, all of our conferences, especially the ones we want to do with Andy and the right stuff, are about educating an author to make the right decision of who's the right person to publish their book out there. Make smart decisions. Make informed decisions that you can see on paper, not just responding to, no offense, author representatives, but mm-hmm. you don't want to just be sold. And that's why we work so closely with Megan. Megan works with authors, and we're so interested in Andy's group that we can help them get the things they need that make sure. the most sense for their book. And that's all this conference is about. It's the neatest way to approach a bunch of people.
And it's a fun day.
And it's a fun day.
Dick Wolfsey's going to do a game show.
Well, that'll be fun.
Called Wait, Wait, Do Tell Me.
Yes.
And we've got unbelievable prizes that will be awarded for the celebrity participants who are going to be trying to answer those tough questions for a member of the audience.
Excellent.
From $500 to $2,500 in value.
Well, Andy, tell me this. I mean, you've been running these conferences now for a while.
Yes, sir.
What is it that you've seen, that you've learned from the process? It's been, what, about 10 years or so you've been running Right Stuff?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is it that you've learned from the past experience that you hope to really bring to this next one?
Well, I think just the talent we have on stage is there to share. Okay, this was my journey. This is what I did. This is mm-hmm. how I wrote this book. This is how I wrote and produced and directed this film. This is how I won these awards. This is a publisher, and this is what you need to know. We have a tremendous amount of information that's available in a fun atmosphere, mm-hmm. an interactive atmosphere with the audience, that you can't find that. Everyone thinks you have to go to New York for these conferences. We do them all over the United States, but this one is sort of our baby. It's our local, mm-hmm. our local celebrities, our local talent, who we say, let's gleefully celebrate the talent that we have right here. It's not always the New York authors. You know, like Michael Sheldon lives in Terre Haute,
mm-hmm.
but he is a nationally recognized best-selling author. So we're bringing that kind of talent to the stage all day long.
Excellent.
Plus
Excellent.
Fun games, fun people, mm-hmm. and it's, I'm very excited about it. It's July 20th. We've got a special promotion. Just call for tickets and ask for the Right Stuff promo code. And it's get two tickets for $30, and it's for the full day. It includes the after party of wine mm-hmm. and cheese. That, our sponsor, is Capri Wines, so we're
excited
about that.
And we're excited to see the opportunity for people who have made it in the arts to interact with people who are trying to find their path in the arts,
right.
and then have some of us there who can enable that path through the arts. There's traditional publishers. They're self-publishers. There are authors who are successful. There will hopefully be in the audience are the authors who are looking to be successful and find the way.
Of course.
And we've given them a virtual smorgasbord of people who can answer any of the questions they have in an open forum where you're not really stuck with the canned answers or looking at a website. You've got access to the actual people who will be there and can do this for you.
And it sounds like a lot of great information even for authors who've already maybe had some success as well.
Yes, certainly. Right. Certainly.
Travis DiNicola with Right Stuff Conference organizer Andy Murphy and Ray Robinson and Megan Weddle from Dog Ear Publishing. The Across the Arts Literary Conference takes place on July 20th at the Palladium in Carmel. More information is available at rightstuffwriters.com. Right Stuff spelled like writing as in handwriting. rightstuffwriters.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter. I'm Matthew Sosi, host of Film Sociology here at WFYI Radio. We want to take a moment to pay tribute to the life and career of Bob Carter. Indiana television viewers know Bob's finest creation as Sammy Terry. Bob Carter died on June 30th at the age of 83. From 1961 to 1989, Sammy Terry and his show Nightmare Theater scared and entertained audiences with his trademark laugh, George, and a slew of horror movies. Even after his show was canceled, television specials and public appearances are still heavily in demand. Bob's other impact on Indianapolis came with his business, Family Music Center, which he owned for a quarter century. Over the last several years, Bob's youngest son, Mark, has taken over the character of Sammy Terry, so Sammy Terry will continue to entertain audiences of all ages for a long time to come. On behalf of WFYI and The Art of the Matter, we want to say thanks to Bob Carter. Thank you for your contribution to Indiana television. Thank you for helping so many young musicians. And thank you for scaring the daylights out of us. Thanks, Bob.
Until we meet again. Many pleasant nightmares. Ha 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 ha
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
There is nothing for midsummer like the cool escape of diving into a good book.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
It so is, and I think we have some literary events to headline our calendar that we call
What'll We Do? In the hammock.
In the perhaps. Hammock. Oh, I love it.
How's that sound? Well,
a little naughty, but hey.
Let's start off with the Vonnegut Memorial Library. They're having a great event on July 13th on Saturday at 1 p.m. And, of course, anyone who loves Vonnegut probably also really enjoys Dan Wakefield. And Dan, the author of Going All the Way and also the Kurt Vonnegut Letters, which he just recently edited, is going to be reading selections from If This Isn't Nice, What Is? He's also going to be signing copies of his books. And so he will be there throughout the day starting at 1 p.m. at the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library. And if you've not been there, you should really go there. And if you're lucky, you'll get the volunteer Max to give you a great tour. I just had one last week.
Excellent. Thanks for the insider tip. Hey, speaking of Dan Wakefield, he is going to be at Indie Reads Books on Saturday, July 13th. That's this Saturday. Why? Because
right after he leaves the Vonnegut Library.
Right after he leaves the Vonnegut Library. He's going to need a good dinner at the end of the day. I hope somebody out there is going to buy him one. He's going to have a big day. It's Indie Reads Books' birthday. Happy birthday. Yay. And they have a whole day's worth of activities, including at 11:30 in the morning, Children's Story Hour. From 3 to 4, author Ben Winters speaks. He wrote Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters.
Yes.
He also teaches at Butler. Dan Wakefield will be there at 4:15. From 5 to 5:30, Taylor Martin's coming in to do a magic show. And from 6 to 9, live jazz music with Sophie Fott, Kenny Phelps, and Nick Tucker. Some great performers. Not only that, but the Cool Bus will be there all day long showing you what they do with and for kids. And there'll be cupcakes, lemonade, prizes, and free books for everyone.
Free books for
How
everyone.
How can you not be there? I'm just saying. Indie Reads Books, Saturday, July 13th, opening at what time?
Opening at 11 a.m.
Opening at 11 a.m., Children's Story Hour at 11:30, live jazz music winding up around 9 or whenever they can kick people out of the store.
There you go. And hey, another great bookstore, our favorite in Irvington, Book Mamas, has some fun events going on this weekend as well, with R.J. Sullivan at 2 p.m. on Saturday the 13th. He's going to be discussing and signing his latest book, Haunting Blue. And then also next week on Wednesday the 17th at 6:30, the Irvington Ukulele Jam. Grab your uke, join the fun. What a good time at Book Mamas.
Who'd have thunk that we would live to an era when the phrase head-banging ukulele music was used with a straight face, no less. Thank you, Steve Martin, for helping to usher that in, by the way. Hey, another author and storyteller and photographer is Glory June Greif. She's published books before, including a spectacular book about public art around the state of Indiana. I'm telling you about her today because she has a photography show up at the Holiday Park Nature Center. It's titled The Wonder of It All, Nature Photographs. It runs through September 8th, but don't wait until the last minute to go. You should maybe go now. You might even go this coming Sunday, the 14th, because from 2 to 4 p.m. there is an opening reception with refreshments, and you can meet Glory June. She is a character and an old-time radio girl herself. So
very fun.
Nice exhibit. Holiday Park Nature Center, 6363 Spring Mill Road. Opening reception this Sunday, 2 to 4, and the show up throughout the summer.
One of my favorite parts of the middle of July is when the Symphony does their free concerts in the park, and they've got three free concerts coming up next week. The first one is at Ellenberger Park on Tuesday the 16th. That starts at 7:30, Ellenberger Park, of course, near Irvington. And then the Garfield Park concert is on Wednesday at 7:30. And then the last of the three free concerts, Holiday Park on Thursday the 18th. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you can see the Symphony three nights in a row, 7:30 showtime. With each night, there are no rain dates. It is a lot of fun. Check it out. Ellenberger, Garfield, and then Holiday Park.
Take your mosquito spray.
Last thing you got, Sharon?
The last thing I have, you've been living in your head with all these literary and musical events, and you need a little physical exercise. Think about the Brown County Night Flight Tour, the next one on July 20th. Headlamps, tiki lit decks, 60 feet in the air, the moon, the stars, zip on into the darkness. Yes, it is a 2.5-hour zip line tour night. You can get more information by just Googling Brown County Nighttime Zip Line.
That sounds great.
I know.
Okay, we'll be back next week with more things to do in and out of your hammock on the calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
For years, people have told Karen Irwin that her voice bears an uncanny resemblance to Janis Joplin's. Karen wanted to do more than just sing the late rock icon's tunes, though. She wanted to create a performance piece that conveys something of Joplin's life and identity. The result is A Piece of Her Heart, a tribute to Janis Joplin, with two performances at the Cabaret at the Columbia Club later this month. Sharon Gamble invited Karen in to find out why she's fascinated with the 60s icon.
Well, other than the fact that your voice is eerily, uncannily like Janis Joplin's, tell me about your relationship with Janis. I mean, she was gone before you were really conscious of music, right?
Right. I think maybe the year before I was conscious at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, the show has a lot to do with that, quite frankly. And I was thinking before I came here what I was going to be able to do without, like, spoiling the whole story.
Sure.
In reference to the kinds of questions that I kind of figured you would ask.
Sure, sure.
I think explaining to you how this show came about will make the most sense. And that is, you know, Tony Press Kaufman used to be playwright at residence of the Phoenix Theater.
Right.
I basically commissioned to help me put this story together.
Uh-huh.
And I called her up, and over the phone, long distance, she's out of Tucson. I kind of told my story of my relationship with Janis, and using artistic license and her own poetic voice and research and really like making things I said way more valid than I ever thought they were. She created this script that has...
Playwrights are good at that, aren't they?
Right? It's so awesome. As the show has 13 Janis songs in it, which is about all everybody knows, quite frankly.
Right.
It pretty much, you get outside of those 13 and you might as well be singing, you know.
Our listeners are in their cars right now going, okay,
how many can you
name? Three. Don't worry, you'll recognize them.
Well, there's a couple you might not, quite frankly.
Okay.
Which is kind of the fun part,
yeah,
too. But I have a long history of singing songs and having people go, now what Janis Joplin song was that? And I have to confess, no, that was Four Non-Blondes, or that was Concrete Blonde. That was Led Zeppelin,
yeah,
you know.
So do you remember the first time you heard a Janis Joplin song?
I do.
Where were you, and who played it for you, or did you just stumble on it somehow?
I think I was in my car, and a girlfriend in high school played Me and Bobby McGee.
Oh.
Yeah. Which I think is everybody's
favorite.
You know,
yeah.
It's like a female
summer anthem. Yeah, exactly, exactly. It comes up in I'm going to mention another radio station on the air at WFYI, sorry management, but it comes up a lot in the WTTS rotation.
Yes, yes,
and
it does.
For good reasons. It's
right.
It's such a rock anthem.
Right.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I mean, I think that was probably the last recorded one that she did. About a year before she died, it was recorded. It was written by Chris Christopherson, as everybody knows.
Yep.
About a year before she died, she recorded that. I think it's here. It might be more like two. But I will say that that's one of those songs that had she lived much longer, she would have been really upset with how much she had to sing it.
Well, you know, there's the silver lining of dying too young, right?
That's the song. They never would have let her get through ever doing anything without singing that song.
That's a good point.
And that's, you know, kind of been one of the things about my singing anywhere is it's always, even if I don't do a single Janis Joplin song, the audience starts asking for that because clearly you can kind of hear it in my voice.
Yeah.
So it's one of those songs that there was a point where I thought, if I never have to sing the song again, I'm going to be totally okay.
So let's talk about that. Do you ever get, is it ever an obstacle, your voice, your vocal resemblance to Miss Pearl? Does that ever get in your way?
You know, I think I think that throughout, you know, singing to me is just, it's another vehicle for storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
It's an opportunity, you know, through a different medium to tell stories. So with that being said, I'm a lyric person. And
it's all about
however,
the words.
And there are certain ways that those lyrics can come out that are more interesting than others. But for the most part, the exploration of my voice started with her and has continued beyond her
mm-hmm.
through different musicians that have been in my life. You know, I mean, I started with karaoke, right?
Right.
Clearly, I ran a karaoke show called Karaoke for 10 years. And then I was in a band called Karen and the Beast, and the guys that were in that band allowed me a vehicle to explore my own voice.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, one of those cats, well, Al Stone was my bass player, one of my favorite humans on the planet. And then after that, one of the keyboard player and I started playing together, Guy Vreeman and I, and that allowed me a vehicle to explore my own voice, and which was greater than, you know, the blues rock band and greater than what a recorded track like karaoke would do. And then I got Scott Ballantyne to play with me. I don't know how. And he's more of a jazz guitar player. And
yeah.
that allowed me a vehicle to explore what else my voice would do.
Right.
So I think, you know, maybe it could have been something that I got stuck in. But because of what I've been graced with as far as musicians, I've just had such an opportunity to see what else, where else it'll go.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of people know you as an actor, and a whole other universe knows you as a singer.
Right.
There's not that much difference in some ways, right?
I think maybe the way I approach it, there's not that much difference.
Yeah.
I think there can be a huge difference, but I think they fill the same thing for me.
Yeah.
That whatever that storytelling thing is, whatever that, you know, connecting with humans thing is, they both kind of fill that. Of course, you know, singing, it's like 3 minutes. It fills it.
Right.
You
acting know?
You get 2 hours.
Yeah.
I remember when I'd been an actor since I was very young. And when I first played with a band, I showed up a half hour early to rehearsal and everybody was like at least a half hour late and already half lit. Like you would never drink a beer on the day of a rehearsal in theater. You wouldn't even have one for lunch,
right,
like five
right.
hours beforehand. It would muddy the brain,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I got there and I was like expecting it to be the same kind of rehearsal process.
Yeah.
And if you do that, you want to kill yourself because what I learned is musicians, actors are generally speaking, you know, when you're working at a theater, you're rehearsing with an already pre-planned production date with tickets already being sold.
Right.
So you have this finite amount of time to rehearse with this already goal in mind. And musicians are rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing, hoping someday someone will let them play, you know, so you can't have the same expectations.
There's also, in some ways, maybe, depending on what kind of music you're doing, more opportunity for a little improvisation.
Yes, absolutely.
On a musical stage than there is on a theater
absolutely.
Stage. Yeah. So I'm curious, actors often, especially women who somehow seem to have less latitude on stage to appear to be different ages. Lots of times men, you can plop down a 40-year-old man and he can play a 60-year-old man or a 20-year-old man.
Mm-hmm.
Women, it's sometimes a little bit more specific. So lots of times actors, especially women, can't wait until they're old enough to play fill in the blank.
Right.
Yeah, Martha in Virginia Woolf or,
right.
or whatever.
Right.
Is that something that happens to singers as well? Is there kind of something you're thinking, I'm not quite old enough to sing this style of music yet, or I'm eager to see what my voice is like in another decade? Do you ever think that way, or is it more living in the moment?
I think it might be like the opposite, almost. I think that, I mean, you listen to, I remember I heard this Etta James concert in maybe it was the 90s or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I have followed her from, like, you know, her 60s Etta to 70s Etta to 80s Etta, and loved how, like, she changes as the music changes.
Sure.
And then you hear her sing At Last, in the last years of her life, and she has fewer notes. She has less range.
Right.
So I think everybody knows that no matter how well you're using your voice, as you age, you lose some of the versatility that you have. I mean, Stevie Nicks, though I'm not sure she was always using it.
That might be a whole different interview.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of things that affect it, but your hope is that, you know, like, I feel like my range has increased, but there will become a point, probably just due to age, where I'll start losing some of that range.
It's an athletic ability.
It kind of is.
In some ways.
Yeah.
Now, I want to mention, but I want to talk a little bit more about music and about this concert, but you've chosen a play that we can't say because it's meant to be a surprise, but you're coming up on Indie Actors Playground.
Yes, ma'am.
And I want you to explain what that is for anybody who hasn't been yet.
Indie Actors Playground was started by Lou Harry and Bill Simmons. Lou Harry being the arts entertainment reviewer for the IBJ, playwright extraordinaire, really involved community member on all grounds. And then Bill Simmons, phenomenal actor, and I don't think he needs to do anything else.
Though he has a long career as an arts administrator as well.
Yes, yeah, well, okay,
but,
whatever.
But
that too.
Yeah.
Lou's been talking about it for a long time. We've all kind of been tossing around, you know, the idea. And then they finally got together and started this Indie Actors Playground where they ask a different actor each month on the second Monday of the month to select a play, to cast it themselves, and read it out loud for whoever chooses to show up at Indy Reads on Massachusetts Avenue, mm-hmm. the bookstore. And it's been really neat so far. I personally, if there was a job where you could just read plays out loud, I would be the happiest girl in the whole U.S. of
A. If anybody has that job, just email us, artofthematter@wfyi.org. We'll hook you up with Karen.
Sometimes I will just befriend playwrights. Don't tell them this. But sometimes I will just befriend playwrights so they let me read things out loud for them.
So why is that a joy for you?
I'll tell you exactly what it is. It is giving a voice to something that has not yet had a voice.
Ah.
It is one of the more exciting things on the planet, especially when it's a brand new spanking play that nobody's ever looked at before, that's never made sound before, and you get to give it this voice that hasn't existed until now.
She's getting shivers as we have this conversation. You can't see it, but she lit up. You lit up.
Now, the plays that we're reading at Indie Reads aren't necessarily those. They're already, you know, they've already been produced. Maybe somebody saw it somewhere. It may not be something that anybody in town feels like they can actually produce in its entirety. And it's not for the purpose of us trying to get it produced in its entirety. It's just for the true joy of reading a play out loud with other talented people that we respect and admire.
But even if you've seen it somewhere else, or even if it's been produced here, there's still some discovery.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. That never gets to end.
So about performing at the cabaret,
mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that, because your native environment, it has been a little bit different kind of space. I mean, you've performed lots of different places on mm-hmm. stages around and about, but often at places that are a little bit more casual.
As far as music?
Yeah. We have bars, clubs.
Bars, venues, yeah.
So is there anything you'll do differently in preparing to sing at the cabaret?
Okay, well, this show in particular, like I said, was created with me by Tony Preskaufman. But prior to that, Diane Timmerman and Steve Webb, I don't know if you remember this, Steve Webb wrote a show and Diane Timmerman directed me in it that we did as a fundraiser for that show we cannot name.
Right.
the show I did with Diane Conrad and The Fringe many years ago, A&A. And a fundraiser for us to go to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve wrote me this great show where I played Janis Joplin and I sang a bunch of songs.
Right.
And that was intimidating as all get out.
Because?
I was playing her. There's something about that makes me nervous. Not to mention then there's some some issues with like rights to image and whatnot that you have to be concerned mm-hmm. about if you start actually making money off the thing.
Sure.
And it's just a whole bucket of worms.
Yeah.
So after this fundraiser, I knew I wanted to sing the songs, but I wasn't sure what format or formula. And of course, Tony helped me with it, and it turns out it's kind of cabaret.
Who knew?
Right?
Janis Joplin and cabaret, three words that have not been said in the same sentence until you.
Stylistically, that's kind of what it is.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, you know, I started hearing that. Well, we did it the first time at the Wagon Wheel in Warsaw a few years ago, and she's such, Janis Joplin is such an easy sell. We had this amazing crowd. I had these musicians that I kind of like, you know, coerced into doing it. And afterwards, I mean, the reception was unlike anything any of us have ever seen. It was this crazy standing ovation. And these people were so happy that, you know, you realize the power of her music, period, that it just makes people so freaking happy that, you know, I would do it. I would just do it forever. You know, if I could get away with it. But then it kind of went on the back burner for a little while. And there was a lot of other things I was doing. And until Shannon at the cabaret got wind of it and said we should do that. And I think for them, it's a little more rock and roll than they've ever done. So it's kind of them pushing their envelope a little. And that's exciting that let's see what happens in this space, right?
Sharon Gamble with Karen Irwin. You can see Karen perform A Piece of Her Heart, a tribute to Janis Joplin, on Friday and Saturday, July 26th and 27th at 8 p.m. at the Cabaret at the Columbia Club. Tickets are going fast, but you can get them now at thecabaret.org. Again, thecabaret.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of this year's Indie Film Fest.
I'll find out about a new novel by a Butler University professor.
And I'll chat with Dance Kaleidoscope's David Ho Choi about their upcoming concert. And there'll be our calendar of events we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.